Just relieved that I can hear you because I wasn't hearing you until this very second.
Okay. Well, I apologize to everyone for the rocky start there. I don't know what you were hearing on your end, but I heard cacophony. So we're going to try to bring some harmony and out of that cacophony. So this is Monica Liel welcoming you to the LL Research Radio Program In the Now Q&A with Carla L. Ruckert. Today's October 12th, 2010. Carla L. Ruckert is an author, mystic, seeker, and primary channel for LL Research. Along with hosting In the Now Q&A with Carla L. Ruckert, I'm the head moderator of the Bring Forth Forums. I will be asking Carla questions that come from you. If you'd like to ask Carla a question, please join the chat room on the webpage for In the Now at blogtalkradio.com/LLResearch. If you'd like to ask Carla a question live on the air, dial 347-884-8770. That number once again is 347-884-8770, and press the 1 key when you're prompted by Blog Talk's automated system. When you call, you'll be able to hear the show, but you will be on mute until I patch you through to Carla. When done with the call, I will put you back on mute, at which time you can either continue listening through the phone or you can listen on your computer. When submitting questions, please remember, this is a Law of One Q&A. Try to keep your questions as spiritually oriented as possible. Again, I'm Monica Liel. I'm talking with Carla L. Ruckert of LL Research. You're listening to the worthy successor to last year's live chat on the Bring Forth website. We've gone for sound now. We hope you like the improvement. Okay, Carla, I'm going to start the show with the first question from one of our Bring Forth members by the name of Rick Daw. And Rick Daw says, I am repeatedly being offered opportunities to help big-hearted people in confounding situations, mostly women. They are oppressed or ignored or abused or marginalized by other selves. Big heart chakras, closed throat chakras. This isn't about criminal level abuse, but about the kind of abuse you might call exploitation by a boss, controlling behavior by a boyfriend, socially cruel behavior by a coworker, etc. These abusers have some serious second and third chakra blockages. I accept that these women have come to me for a reason and that I'm being offered an opportunity to be of service. I used to be a lawyer. My question is whether I should or not. To nourish empowerment for the victim, teach them how to speak for themselves, I know it will mean pain for the oppressor. It could be the pain of a work grievance, divorce, lawsuit, or direct discomfort by being confronted, but is real pain for the oppressing individuals. Is it okay to help these oppressed women because they search me out by seeking my advice? Or is the catalyst actually that I'm supposed to see the big picture and choose not to help the oppressed, because to help these women is likely to hurt the oppressors? What do you do when your heartfelt principles, defend and empower the oppressed, conflict with the larger reality that the oppressor too is another self? Who knows what pain or abuse they had while growing up that made them into the cruel people they have become? In all likelihood, they are victims too. What action comports with the law of one, to engage or not to engage? Never once has an oppressor come to me saying, I keep falling into a pattern of dehumanizing my wife. Can you help me break this cycle of abuse? So there has been no opportunity to offer loving help to the oppressor, which would solve my quandary.
Okay, well, let's sort this out. The desire to be of help to people is at the very heart of attempting to polarize in service to others. The monkey mind, as I call the mind of our biocomputer, that is part of the equipment that we are born with genetically in this life, goes straight to a solution. And if you go straight to a solution, then you're missing the spiritual aspect that you're being offered. And that's what you're guessing. That's what you're feeling. And you don't know what's missing. You think that it's either you help the oppressed in some legalistic way, or you refrain from helping and consequently do not rain down the law upon the oppressor. Okay. Now, this is the way most people see the problems of the workplace or the marriage or the relationship. However, it is not the way the Law of One sees the contracts involved. Here's what's actually happening. There is a contract between the oppressor and the oppressed, which was made before either one of them was born, and about which perhaps neither of them knows. That contract was that they were going to try to help each other to reduce distortion in their balances between love and wisdom, wisdom and power, or love and power. Generally, if there is abuse going on of the type that you mentioned, social, emotional, and so forth, people have forgotten the contract and they're not working on it. So what you're doing is you are focusing on mostly women, you said, and you are targeting them as the oppressed. Now, that's not actually true. Nobody is oppressed. They are receiving catalyst. They can choose how to react to the catalyst. If they react in a loving way, it is possible that there can be a gradual change in the relationship for the better. But that's not actually what you're aiming at. What you're aiming at is dialing the person in to the game of life and how it's played on the enhanced game board of the Law of One. Instead of saying, okay, I see you're a victim here, you say, okay, I see that you are relating to this person as if you were a victim. You do not have to choose to be a victim. But in order not to choose that, you're going to have to do some work on yourself. You're going to have to see that this oppressor is mirroring to you aspects of your personality with which you have not yet dealt in this life with enough skill to bring them in an integrated way into your waking daylight personality. They have remained part of your shadow personality. So there is that within you which wants to oppress, which wants to have the upper hand, which wants to have control. Find that and heal that in yourself and stop feeling oppressed. Now, when you have worked with that person along those lines until that person is completely understanding of what you were saying. Then you can say, now, do you still feel that you need some legal help in removing yourself from this situation at work, in your marriage, and so forth? And if the person then says, yes, I believe I would appreciate that kind of advice, and then I can decide whether or not to use it in a loving manner, then you can go ahead and give that person the benefit of your wisdom that you have learned, you know, for the precise purpose of helping people in that situation. But the spiritual aspect, the metaphysical aspect of it comes in as you educate the person first to the idea that she can remove herself from the cycle of abuse by refraining from considering herself a victim, and instead by working with this catalyst to balance herself and to fulfill her part of the contract, which was to reduce her distortion, which involved perhaps an unwise ascendancy of love over wisdom. Monica, does that make sense to you?
It absolutely does. It absolutely does. I'm not sure I even have a follow-up to that.
Okay. Well, tell the guy, Rick, whoever it is, that if he would like to, that he could write out a follow-up, and I'll be glad to work with the ideas further.
Okay. Wonderful. All right. I'm going to move to another question. This is from, I'm just going to use the initial D because I wasn't, this was sent via email, and I'm not sure if this person wants their name, their real name on the air, so I'm just going to say D. So D says, I have a question about parenting. I am having some issues with my teenage son. He is now 19, but these problems have been going on for the last couple of years. He's been making some choices that trouble me. The main things that bother me are binge drinking and experimenting with drugs. I'm finding it hard to figure out where to draw the line and if I even should draw the line. When does a teenager become an adult? When should I discipline and when should I accept it as his own free will? He's hardly at home lately anyways, so there isn't much I could do to discipline him. He would just leave. I've had periods in my life where I did similar things, so I try not to judge it too much. But as a parent, I feel like I should be doing something. When I even try to question him, he gets extremely angry and accuses me of trying to control him. The slightest question can set him off, and he will scream and yell and use obscenities. My husband, who is living away from us for work this past year, tells me to just throw him out when he starts being disrespectful. But I feel, as a mother, that I should always be there for him. I do try to let him know that I love him regardless, and I know he has a good heart. It can also be frustrating when his chores don't get done. Sometimes I just do them myself. Sometimes we get along wonderfully. I feel like I must tiptoe around his feelings, though. Any help you could give me on this problem would be greatly appreciated. Love, D.
Okay, D. It's a painful situation to be in. And I think that your situation is that you are paying his expenses and he is living in your home. Consequently, you do have the right to question his activities when they are not socially acceptable according to the rule of life that you have had in your home all during his childhood. Now, I am assuming that you yourself do not take drugs or otherwise have the capacity to act as a bad example. If you are yourself drinking or doing drugs, then you really have no legs to stand on. And the question is, do you want your son to live at home and put up with whatever he's doing, or do you want him to experience what it's like to be out in the world with no help, so that he gets more of an idea about the nature of adult responsibility? You can't have it both ways. Either you're going to do whatever it takes to keep him at home, or you're going to draw a line in the sand and say, as long as you are in this house, I would ask that you not do any hard drugs. I don't think that binge drinking is something that a person is going to sustain for long. If you notice that he's doing it every week or every day, then you're going to have a problem, or he has a problem that you're going to be aware of. If he's doing it socially, hanging out with a crowd and drinking only when he's with that crowd on the weekend, that kind of thing burns itself out usually in the college years, or at least by the time you reach 30. That's really not something to worry about. Consequently, I would probably bite my tongue and let it be if that's all it is. If it's everyday drinking, then you simply need to go to Al-Anon and start working on the skills of removing yourself from this contract, because of the fact that if there is serious drinking or serious everyday drugs that is impairing his functioning, then he will not listen to anybody until he has hit bottom. I had a parent who was an alcoholic, and I know what tough love is from the inside out. Okay, if when you say drugs, you're actually meaning marijuana, again, I think this is typically something that burns itself out as far as, you know, overuse of marijuana will burn itself out in college. It's just not something that works with most people's lifestyles once they get into a job where they're working. They really can't do it and work, and so the marijuana goes on the shelf until you get home and in an appropriate situation to use it. If it's hard drugs, even if he's only used them once, that is a cause for alarm, because of the fact that hard drugs, unlike marijuana or alcohol, are not medications that go away. They addict you. So, again, you're in the situation of saying, son, you're in an addictive situation. This is not acceptable in my house. And then watching him go away, or biting your tongue and going to Al-Anon or Alateen or whatever Al that works for you. You need to figure out what his situation is as best you can and then respond appropriately. So basically I would ask you this. Do you really want him to stay with you at all costs? What is service to others? Is a mother's service to others to support her son in bad decisions? At 19, I would say the answer is probably no. You probably need to find your spine and express yourself to him in a loving way, saying that you're concerned and naming the things that you're concerned about very specifically. And don't, for heaven's sake, be disturbed because he's disturbed. He rants because he is allowed to rant. He knows that he is on shaky ground. And so he projects all the more, thinking that somehow this is going to work. And so far it has worked with you. You've been intimidated by him. Don't be intimidated by him. He's your boy. You will always love him, and he knows that. But it's possible that using some tough love now will save him a whole lot of misery later in life. I wish you luck with this.
Okay, Carla, I actually do have a follow-up question to that, having, you know, being a mother myself. Something, I mean, my son's already 22, so it's kind of, we're kind of past that. But I know when he was younger, the question that kept coming up for me was, how do I respect the free will of a child, in which is in alignment with the Law of One principles to always respect the free will of others, and yet obviously children need some sort of discipline. You can't just, you know, especially when they're little, you know, you just can't just let them run around on their own. So I'm wondering if you could maybe comment a little bit on how to reconcile the necessity of imposing some sort of strictures on a child when you're, you know, reconcile that with Law of One principles of respecting their free will.
Okay. There is no question but that when you have a child on your hands, you have to interfere with their free will because they are untutored, completely untutored in the ways of earth. So a lot of parenting has to do with setting boundaries, very simple boundaries, and then keeping to them. I remember when my little brother, whom I raised until the age of 7, because my mother was not only working full-time but was also taking classes full-time for her PhD, at the time that Tommy was born, she just sort of dropped him between semesters and then moved on. And I was delighted to take care of him. I was 14 at the time. He was a miracle baby, not expected to be born at all. So I had the care and feeding of my little brother, Tommy, until I married at the age of 21 when he was 7. And there were very simple rules. You know, you misbehaved at home. You didn't misbehave in public. And the way that behavior was considered good and then not good was carefully defined. You know, you didn't nag, you didn't whine, you didn't holler in public. And if you did those things, then you had to go home. A couple of instances, one in a movie theater and the other in a bakery, where he started acting up, wanting more than I had the money for, both times, made me leave the food in one case and leave the movie in the other case after I'd bought the food and after I'd bought the tickets because he was misbehaving. And I said, well, my goodness, you really can't misbehave in public. We're going to have to go home. And he said, but bring the, what do you mean, bring the food? And I said, no, we're just going to go home now. And after he realized that misbehaving in public was going to cost him a movie or food or whatever it was that we were doing, he realized that he couldn't misbehave with me and still get his goodies, so he didn't misbehave anymore. Now, he did misbehave with my parents. He did not misbehave with me. And we had a very good understanding, and there was all kinds of love between us, and I would do anything for Tommy. I gave him my Saturdays. I spent all day with him if he needed it. He didn't need it past a certain point, but, I mean, I was delighted to be with him at all times. And the only thing, if it was, there were certain rules, and I would remind him of them if necessary, and he would go, oh, okay, right. So this is helpful to young ones. They are comfortable only when they know where the boundaries are, and they're comfortable testing them, and they really like it when you push back and say, no, this is the boundary, not with anger but with love. Listen, my beloved child, I am in this position. I need to do my best for you, and this is the way the world wags. So here is the set of rules that we tend to play by. Here are the ways that you can oil the machinery of society. And you offer the best wisdom that you have, and you give it in a loving way. And above all, you make yourself available. You always are there to answer questions. You are there to share fun. You are there to laugh as well as discipline. It's not all about discipline. It's always about this is something that I feel is needed in your life until you get on your own. When you get on your own, you can make your own decisions. So I think that what the Law of One suggests is that it is indeed the parent's job to be a good teacher, a good mentor, a good guide that explains society, explains how society works in such a way that the person is ready to be of service to others just as the parent is. Because kids learn by imitation for the most part. If they see that you are, for instance, worshiping in some way every day, meditating, walking in nature, addressing the need to spend time with the Creator, that child is going to have an aspect of his life that he didn't have before. If you share your stories with him in terms of disciplining him, you not only say, here's the rule, but then you illustrate it out of your own life, and you're there to talk to the child afterwards. As long as he wants to talk, that is being kind in terms of the Law of One. So all of those things really help to square the love one and the unconditional love with what the child needs in terms of limits and boundaries, so that he can not just be driven insane by every desire that pops into his head.
Okay. All right. Thank you. We have another question from someone in our chat room that is slightly related, a different type of caregiver role. This is from My Chi Heart, who is online in our chat room, and says, "Hi, Monica and Carla. In a caregiver role with sister who has numerous health issues but have been myself out of circulation in fear of something negative happening to my sister. Having so many conflicting emotions about getting myself out into the world and staying home with the sister, the brother-in-law passed a year ago. Myself, I've not been in a relationship for many years, and I'm getting nudges to find a partner. Any insights?"
Wow. Maiti, it sounds like you've got quite a contract on your hands. So apparently you set this up in order to be of service to this person. And your highest and best self is telling you that you need to be at home with this person and be a caretaker. Apparently, you do not have any physical needs. They seem to be taken care of. So that's not a problem. I don't actually see a problem with your pursuing finding a friend, a lover, a mate. You are just like a person with a child, and people with children get remarried every day. So admittedly, for someone so young, it is an unusual piece of baggage that is on board your ship of state, shall we say, as you sail along on your spiritual journey, but there it is. So I would say do what's in front of your face to do. Take care of the sister that has all the health problems, and don't let yourself become victimized by that situation. Simply stay open to the possibility of relationship, and when it comes, say, "Look, you know, there's a situation here that I don't feel I can turn my back on. Can you deal with me having a sister that needs special care?" And here's hoping that the woman, I'm assuming you're a guy, that you find is a high-quality person that says, "Hey, let's do this together."
Okay. Do you have any follow-ups? Okay, hold on one second. Getting the chat here. Okay, My Chi Heart says, "Not so young myself, but thank you." Okay.
I think we're all about 17 in our hearts.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, we've actually got our first live caller, and I'm going to unmute this caller from area code 323. Hello, are you with us? Looks like they hung up. So, yeah, hopefully.
We'll call back.
Okay, well, call back. We lost you. I don't know what happened there, but feel free to call back from area code 323. Okay, so meanwhile, I'm going to take a question from the forum from Carrie. "Hi, I have a question about near death. My experience of near death is from an initially frightening to immense love. I was walking around what seems to be a tunnel, and then a light appeared at the end of it. I walked towards it. The light came nearer and nearer. I found myself walking around what seems to be a place whiter than white, hearing sounds more melodious than anything I'd ever heard on earth, immense feeling of love greater than anything I've ever received on earth. The first few steps, the places where I touched upon, changed from white to yellow, then yellow, reddish, orange color. The next few steps were like the feeling of moving without effort. Closest equivalent is like flying. And then I went to a place where the light was very bright, then got brighter and brighter and brighter, whiter than the whitest white. There I felt the feeling of warm love raining down, getting warmer and warmer. The feeling of love is like the outside on the hottest day of summer, and the loving warmth is like being loved or hugged 1,000 times. When I was exposed to the light, love, all the feelings of self-judgment, hate, every negative human emotion melted away. Money seemed to have no value there. Only sharing, love, and kindness mattered there instead. I walked then flying around like three buildings wide, around approximately 50 steps of a human walking. The last few feet, meters, were so lovingly warm, and I felt the heat of the intense light. I thank whoever is doing this who gave me a chance to go back. This sounds unusual. What kind of advice would you give to someone in that area? Do you have any idea where the place is in the context of the Law of One? Thank you.
Okay, Monica. Did I miss anything at the very beginning? Did that person say he was dreaming or had a vision or...
My experience of near death. Near death. Yeah, and this is
all
from
right.
Carrie.
All right, Carrie. Okay, that's the part that I wasn't attending to. Sorry about that. Okay, here we go. Yes, I know precisely where you were. I've been there. It's a wonderful place to be. It's the other side of the experience of space-time. It's called time-space or metaphysical reality. And it's far more real, as you saw, than this. It's the experience of moving into that reality is like going from a black and white movie into color. All of a sudden, you're seeing everything in color. I mean, the colors are actually alive and living and moving. So it's quite a mind-blowing thing, and that's what it's like to die. So it's the best-kept secret because of the fact that we generally don't cross the bounds of physical life and death and then come back to tell the story. But your experience, like many, many near-death experiences, is a beautiful example of the fact that, oh, my goodness, it's just wonderful. And, of course, when I was there, I was 13, and I died of kidney failure. And in the 2 minutes or so that they spent trying to revive me, I was on the other side having an experience much like that. But into this beautiful music, which, by the way, was making sparkles in the air. You may have noticed sparkles in the air. A big old sparkle in the air came, and it was a voiceover. It was just a disembodied voice that said, that I had chosen a difficult incarnation and that they didn't usually do this, but that if I wanted, I would be allowed to come back for two different lifetimes and do the jobs that I had agreed to do, one job in one lifetime, the other job in the other lifetime. And I thought to myself, gee, that would mean two more childhoods, and I'm almost through this childhood, and it's been a difficult childhood. So I decided that I was going to come back into this life and deal with the catalyst of having a frail body and get it done. And so I came back, boom, all of a sudden. You know, it switches from being in this reality to being in the other reality with no space in between. I didn't even have the tunnel. I was just out of pain and into a completely unblemished body in this incredible, living, colorful, wonderful universe. And then, boom, back into my painful body there on the hospital bed. So I've been there. I know what it is. And it's just simply you moved into your indigo ray body, which is the body you rode in on in the first place. You just about dissolved the cord that held your energy body to your physical body, and therefore you were able to see the other side. And then when you came back, you were no longer able to see that. It's there all the time. We just can't see it because we're beyond the veil of forgetting. So it's a wonderful experience, and the only experience I have heard that wasn't a near-death experience that sounded a good bit like that was when Don Elkins had his initiation into the Golden Dawn, which happened spontaneously when he was meditating with me in 1968. Other than those two experiences, I don't think there's any way that you remain and rest in that reality. It's a lovely reality to be in, and what you need to do in order to make the most use of it in this life is to recall at all times that all is well. All really is well. All is perfect, just the way you saw it then. And against all the information that your mind keeps feeding you about how bad everything really is, you know, in so many ways, you simply remain faithful to your memory. And you know, because it's subjective memory, it's something that you experienced, you can trust it. So stay with that, use it in your life, and you will remain in metaphysical time space. You will remain in eternity and in infinity, and you will be a wonderful witness to love in this life. Follow up, Monica?
No, I don't think I do. That's great. Okay, I'm going to go ahead and move on to another question from Peel Street Guy. Hi, Carla and Monica. I have a few questions concerning a ritual. I've been getting stronger urges to perform the banishing ritual of the lesser pentagram for about 2 years, but I never get around to doing it because I don't have a room to dedicate to rituals. Could I perform it around myself instead of around an entire room? Would it travel with me or stay where I performed it? I'm a little sketchy about the hexagram part. Why isn't it drawn like the pentagrams? Also, could you explain the metaphysical implications involved in this ritual? Your use of the banishing ritual of the lesser pentagram during the raw contact leads me to believe you know how to do it properly, and I would like to learn from someone that I know can do it properly. Thank you for being here with us.
Well, hey, Peel Street Guy. It's really good to hear your energy and your voice, and I'll do the best I can to answer your question. The banishing ritual of the lesser pentagram, for those who don't know what the heck we're talking about, is something that Don checked out with those of Ra during the time that we were having the Ra sessions between 1981, January 15th, 81, and I think our last session was in 84. We had 106 sessions during that time, and we had quite a bit of interference. There was a very strong entity that wanted to stop us cold, if that entity possibly could. It was a fifth density negative entity, according to those of Ra. And so we were trying to clean the place, not just the room in which the ritual, the Ra sessions were held, but the entire house on a daily basis. And so we all learned the ritual, and there's quite a bit of visualization that goes into it. I think the first question, Monica, you checked me on these questions. I think the first question had to do with why the six-pointed star, the Star of David that starts the ritual, is not drawn. I can tell you that. The reason that it's not drawn is that it is made up of the feminine principle and the masculine principle. The feminine principle is a downward pointing pyramid like a diaper. The male principle is the delta, the upward pointing principle. And if you move those two together, they click and they create third density, the density of polarity, the density of choice. The male-female polarity defines a great deal of the magical space of third density, and it could be considered love and wisdom, for instance, or love and power as opposed to wisdom and power, love and power being the feminine principle, wisdom and power being the masculine principle. So the way I visualize it is strictly because I have a wonderful husband who can be trusted to be interested. And so I picture the feminine principle, and then I just picture that male principle going, shoop, yes, and snapping it up, you know, reaching and the female principle waiting, and the two come together, and that is the guiding glyph of that particular ritual. It basically the sealing, and then you draw the wall, so you draw the pentagrams and vibrate the name to enliven them as you start at the east and then move around east, south, west, and north using the sacred names. And by the way, where it says that first one, Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, we found and Ra confirmed that Yod-Heh-Shin-Vav-Heh is the way you vibrate towards the east to begin that with. Now, remember that before you do those pentagrams, you draw upon yourself the mystical cross, and it's you're vibrating that cross before you begin with the visualizations, except for the cross. So you start out with the ceiling. You draw the cross, which you are standing under as the magical person that is cleansing the space. Then, after you have carefully drawn the pentagrams on the four directions, you call the archangels that belong to each direction. You start with the Raphael, and the energy of air. And I always ask of Raphael after I have visualized him in his robe. I say, breathe on me, breath of God. Then you say, behind me, Gabriel, and the gifts and powers of water. And I always say, wash me thoroughly from my wickedness. Then you say, on my right hand is Michael. And Michael contains the gifts and powers of fire. And I always say to Michael, I say, touch me with the sword of your truth. And then on my left hand is Ariel. It's spelled U-R-I-E-L, but it's pronounced Ariel. And I always say, help me to serve, because I have trouble fully becoming incarnate in earth. I'm better on other densities than this one, but I really need to get into this one completely. And so I always ask for help in serving on earth from Ariel. And once you have named the archangels and you have visualized everything very clearly, you're just absolutely full of light. This visualization is full of light. The ceiling of the Star of David is full of light. The cross is full of light. The pentagrams are full of light. And, of course, the archangels are full of light and color. And then you begin and end with the cross. And then the ritual comes to an end, and you flip your hands up or however you wish to end it, and maybe clap, and then you're done with it. Now, I think the second question is, what am I doing metaphysically? Well, metaphysically, you are clearing space of all vibrations except those that you have allowed with the visualization of the pentagrams, the cross, the Star of David, and your holy words. You know, but perhaps others don't, that the banishing ritual of the Lesser Pentagram is given in the form that we use it by W.E. Butler in a book called The Magician, His Training, and His Work. I believe it is still available in paperback from Amazon.com. You really have to study before you can do this ritual properly. You have to, for instance, you have to memorize what the robes are colored like for each of the archangels so that you can see them and visualize them. You need not to have a fuzzy idea of what they look like, but a very precise idea that is your job as the magician. And you also need, before you begin, to tune up to this ritual. Jim and I have done the ritual for ever since 1981. And we continued doing it after the raw contact stopped, and we do it every morning at the end of our morning offering. So we are tuning up for about a half an hour before we do the ritual. And it's very important that you are in your magical personality when you do the ritual. I even visualize myself in a special gown that is strictly used for magical rituals. And then when I end the ritual, I take that gown off in my visualization and I go back to my everyday self. Always be sure you end a magical ritual by doing that. You cannot sustain the magical personality in everyday life. Nobody can except possibly Jesus the Christ, and you see what happened to him. So it's really a good idea not to do that, to walk around in your imperfect everyday self, breathing everyday air, and not try to pretend that you're a magician when you actually can only sustain that persona for minutes at a time. Monica, what did I miss?
I think you covered everything. Now, maybe the part about the hexagram instead of a pentagram, I'm not quite sure what he meant by the hexagram, because what we're drawing is a pentagram. So,
well, we're not. You see, we're starting with a six-pointed star. And that's made up of the two principles, the male principle of the upward-pointing pyramid clicking together with the downward-pointing pyramid of the female principle. So that polarized male and female energy creates the world as far as that magical ritual is concerned. It's only after you've visualized that as basically the roof of the room that you're drawing in the air with light that you work on the walls. And the walls are pentagrams. The walls are five-pointed stars. But you don't draw the six-pointed star because that's a matter of visualization.
Okay. That cleared it up for me. Thank you. I think you've covered the questions. Now, we've got about 10 minutes left, and there aren't any other questions. So I would ask a follow-up on that same topic if perhaps you could just elaborate a little bit. I'm a little curious I'm just wondering, some people who might be listening to this might be thinking, a pentagram, oh my gosh, you know, that for a lot of people who've been brought up in Christianity, there's kind of a connotation of Satanism or black magic or something like that. Could you maybe elaborate on that just a bit? How is that reconciled with your mystical Christianity, or how do you see it as not something, you know, something of the light and rather than something that's satanic, which is what some people may think it is?
Right. Well, to begin with, satanic magic is a knockoff. It is all imitation. There's nothing original about it. And if, for instance, the pentagrams are always upside down, and the cross is always upside down, it's taking the sacred rituals of positive magic and making them negative. So that's nothing but a shadow, and it belongs in the shadow world along with service to self people. We who are attempting genuinely and earnestly and sincerely to be service to others to the best of our ability, despite our secret thoughts and despite our human nature, are genuinely attempting to form a magical personality and awaken within ourselves so much respect for ourselves that we believe ourselves capable of being responsible servants of the light. And as far as the type of magic that is involved in that banishing ritual of a lesser pentagram, it is the same magic that you watch the priest perform every single time that he goes to the altar and blesses the bread and the wine, and as Episcopalians believe, creates the living Christ within the bread and the wine, so that those who take the bread and the wine into their bodies are actually transformed into Christ and carry that sacred energy with them where they go. That is a good example of a positive magical ritual in the white Western magical tradition, which is what W.E. Butler writes about. Don and I both really loved W.E. Butler's work and studied it quite a bit long before we began receiving information from those of Ra. But Don asked extensively about the white magical tradition and forming the magical personality during his conversations with those of Ra. And if you just Google under magical personality on our site, llresearch.org, or go to lawofone.info, and again, there's a search engine where you can just type in magical personality, you're going to get a bunch of quotations that will help to explain what it is that the Confederation meant by having a magical personality. And basically what it means is your highest and best self. It's that place that you can come into when you have cleared your lower chakras, you are, for the purposes of the moment, at peace with the world, you're at peace with your relationships, you're at peace with your work, your marriage, your children. All of those things have melted away. You are capable of speaking honestly, your blue chakra is open. You know, not only your heart's open, but your blue chakra has to be open so that you can get into the indigo ray chakra, which is where you're doing this work. When you move into the indigo ray chakra and you're vibrating at that chakra, you are capable of opening the gateway to intelligent infinity according to your desire and according to the intention that you set. Now, the gateway to intelligent infinity can be seen to be a good deal like the top of a pyramid as far as how the energy is going to work. At the top of the pyramid, you have a third twist of the energy, a spiral of that energy. The Ra always calls the light the upward spiraling light. And as it spirals through us, it twists as it comes into us, circulating in our hearts. It twists again as it enters the gateway to intelligent infinity. And as it moves through, it gives a third spiral and opens up into, if you could consider that in terms of a computer, it opens up a menu. Now, the menu that's available to us while we're in the body here in third density Earth is relatively limited. You can open the body to healing energy, which means that it bounces back down to the green ray chakra and stays there. And the healing energy works from the green ray chakra. You can bounce from the menu down to the heart chakra and back up to blue ray, which is where I am right now. I tuned before this radio broadcast to my hopefully highest and best self at the moment. And I asked that my blue ray would be open, that I could communicate in truth and in love. Or you can decide that you really want to focus on radiance of being, just simple radiance of being, experiencing yourself as the creator. And that means you've pulled energy through the gateway from time-space into space-time. You have catalyzed it in your heart, in the green ray chakra. It bounces back up to the indigo ray chakra, and then you're vibrating there. Now, what are you doing? Well, you could just be passively radiating light. You could be meditating on a particular thing, a particular image. You could be simply counting your breaths once you get there in order to keep yourself focused. You could be walking in nature. But the basic characteristic of working with the indigo ray is that you are in the immediate presence of the Creator. I like to think of it as tabernacling with the Creator. And it is in that indigo ray energy that you do magical rituals. Your magical personality has been activated. You are operating far above your usual hit and miss energy, guaranteeing for this moment that you are completely focused in worship. Worship is a strong word, but that is the energy which you need to be capable of in order to have and work with your magical personality. Monica, what about that was remains a mystery to you?
Actually, it's not really a mystery to me, but I just thought it would be a good question for the benefit of those who might not be familiar with the LBRP and might be wondering about it. So I think that that definitely clears it up quite well. So,
okay, I have a question for you. Remember the guy, Michael, that called last week, and I had this unfortunate static that was so thick I couldn't hear through it? And
yeah.
I tried to answer his question, but I was like, not doing too well because I wasn't hearing the question. I was guessing at the question. Did he call back, and did he tell you what his question was?
You know, he did. Well, he called back, and we actually had a wonderful conversation for about 20 minutes, and I had hoped he was going to call in his question again today, but he didn't actually ask me to ask the question again, but I do have his phone number, so I will get with him and see if he'd like it asked next week, and then we can maybe explore it further because when we have more time. We're actually out of time. It's 5:55. But I do have his contact information, so we can hopefully address that.
Oh, I'm so glad. Well, do we have a little minute for me to make a couple of thoughts,
Absolutely.
Just a couple of parting thoughts? Number one
Absolutely.
Parting thought is a shout-out to Gary, who is completely out of reach of my human voice at this time. He is in the Rockies taking a hiking tour for a week and a much-deserved vacation. And our thoughts all go out to Gary at this time. Number two, we want you to know, Monica and I, that we managed to get onto the air only by the hardest. Without Gary coaching both of us, it was touch and go all the way. But we are so glad
that
we're here.
Yes.
And number three, we do have public meditations every Saturday night at 8:00. And I will be channeling for the next two I will be channeling for the foreseeable future because I'm going to visit Jim's mom at the beginning of December. So I'll miss a Sunday there. So I will be channeling every single time the door opens in November and December. So if you happen to be coming this way, please come. It's always fun to have new people in the circle with their fresh energy and fresh questions. So I invite you to join us. And we're just really happy to be with you, and thank you all so much. It is such a pleasure to share one-on-one with you, and that's the whole reason behind the Q&A show. And thank you so much, Monica, for being the host here, the hostess. And,
absolutely.
God bless everybody until next week.
Okay. And you know what? Don't leave yet. We have an announcement. We have gone prime time. We now have a sponsor, and we've got a month of premium service. And then the next month after that, we've got our sponsor. He's going to help us out. So starting next week, we're going to move the show to Fridays, starting on Friday, October 22nd. Now, Carla, did we ever figure out the time? Was it going to be 8 p.m. or 9 p.m. Eastern?
9 p.m.
It's 9 p.m.
Because at 9 p.m. Eastern, it's 6 p.m.
Pacific,
where a good many of our listeners actually live. So that means that they'd be able to get home from work, get clear, at least be on the way home, and then they could dial us in. So it's really the move is so that we can contact both coasts in the same show.
Yeah, perfect. Okay, so the next show will be Friday, October 22nd at 9 p.m. Eastern, and we ask everyone to please bear with us as we navigate these technical challenges. We did have some challenges last week. We had a few challenges at the beginning of this show this week, so thank you for your patience as we get accustomed to our new format with the new premium service. So thank you once again for your service, Carla, and everyone out there, you have been listening to LL Research's In the Now with Carla L. Ruckert. I'm your host, Monica Liel. If you've enjoyed the show, please visit our two websites. The first, llresearch.org, is LL Research's archive website, home to over 1,500 channeling transcripts, 11 publications, The Law of One material, interviews, speeches, and more. The second is bringforth.org, and that's bring the number four, PH, bringforth.org, LL Research's community website featuring forums, blogs, chat rooms, and more. Thanks so much for listening in, and a special thank you to those who submitted questions. If you'd like to submit a question for Carla before the next show, please visit the Bring Forth forums at www.bringforth.org, navigate to the miscellaneous section, and post to the thread Q&A with Carla L. Record, submitting questions. Or you can submit a private question to me at magicalmoons@gmail.com. That's magic with a K, M-A-G-I-C-K-A-L, moons@gmail.com. Have a wonderful week. We will be here next Friday, the 22nd, at 9 p.m. Eastern, and we will see you then.